Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
In this life, one thing counts in the bank, large amounts. I'm afraid these don't grow on trees. You got to pick a pocket or two. You got to pick a pocket or two, boys.
You got to pick a pocket or two.
Large amounts don't grow on trees. You got to pick a pocket or two.
Let's show a bit how to do it, my dear.
Why should we break our backs stupidly paying tax? Better get some untaxed income. Better pick a pocket or two. You gotta pick a pocket or two, boys. You gotta pick a pocket or two.
Why should we all break our backs?
Self-destructive? Did you think, was there a part of you not maybe seeing it in that way, but feeling afraid of what might be out there?
I was always a talented student, you know, but to be honest, I was never really interested in school. Like it seemed a bit fake, you know, the exam, like the teachers put a little exam on you.
It is fake. Well.
Yeah. But now here was like a real game and I could make enough money to escape poverty forever, to buy myself out of slavery. I could reach a place where I never have to work again. But also, I was finally playing the game that was real, you know, with the big dicks, and I could show them that I was better. And but also show myself, like it was like the finally we're in the real game now, and I need to do this. It was a thing that I needed to do for me. And did I know? I think at the time I was too young. I didn't know what I didn't. You know, I was. We're talking. I'm 22, 23 here. You know.
See the point you made earlier. I always think it's like I have some friends who are stand-up comedians. And I know quite a few stand-up comedians.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, that compulsion to stand in front of a crowd, right? And many of them are no good one-to-one.
Yeah.
Great in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
And it's like an emptiness the size of an ocean that'll never be filled.
Yeah. You
know, they got to go out in front of that crowd. They've got to hear that crowd laughing.
Yeah.
And that's the fix.
Yeah.
That's the insecurity, you know, being temporarily solved.
Yeah.
You know.
I think this is a big thing I wanted to... I think this kind of intensity of ambition, I think we lionize ambition in our society, but I think ambition of this kind of intensity very rarely comes from a healthy place. And I'm not saying ambition is always bad. That I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that ambition. Yeah. And I wouldn't be able to do the YouTube that I do and the work that I do, which I think is very important, if it wasn't for that ambition. But now when I wanted to show these ambitious people and I wanted to give like a glimpse of the trauma behind it and what drives it. Because I don't think it came for me from a healthy place. And I'm grateful for it, but there's a dark edge to it and there's a dangerous edge to it.
And it sort of obliterates, you know, it obliterates the rest of your life, really. I mean,
that's the story. I mean,
what you haven't said when you're talking about this is that you were the first person in the office every morning. I mean, if someone came in at 6 o'clock, you went in at 5:45. If they went in at 5:45, you were there at 5:30. This is from the very start.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you understood the importance of the wild socializing at nights then. You know, you were going with these guys from an early stage, often drinking until 4 a.m, then back in the office at 6.
Yeah.
You know, this driven boy who was going to be...
Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of... There'll be young boys running around the streets outside here who are the same. You know what I mean? It's just, this is what we drill out a lot of our young men to be. We tell them, listen, you have to be the best. You know what I mean? That's what that's...
What's the question that when you talk to young people, what do they ask you most? What's the question they
ask? By a million miles, without any shadow of a doubt, the most common question I get from young people is, how do I make money?
Yeah.
And that's, there's no competition for that. And I was at a friend's 50th birthday party, and his nephew's a friend of the channel. And he goes to me...
Because you have a YouTube channel, we should say.
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel where I talk a lot about inequality.
We're going to come back to all that redemption.
He says, how do I make money? And the reason I do the work that I do now, what do I say to these people? Because look, okay, I have this freakish gift which drove me to these places and drove me to the edge of insanity in a way. But if you're an ordinary kid, I think that we've created this horrific landscape for young people, especially young men, but not just young men, where we tell them, you are the money you make. Your value is determined by the money you make, the success you have. And yet we've created an economy in which it's almost impossible for them to make any realistic kind of money.
Yeah.
I think that is the mental health problems it's causing. And
because that is the thing with the ambition you talk about, and you talk about, like, because you weren't just we come back to the real life consequences. Yeah. And there's, like, the book is so funny on this, because you're working in the bank, and the banking system in 2008, 2009 is collapsing, and yet everyone on your desk is making
tons of money
because it's collapsing.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the banks, you know, the imminent bankruptcy of our own employer was of no concern to anyone. We all knew that we'd get bailed out. But before that, you just write as well. Firstly, we regarded the role that our employer was playing in the demise of both the global banking system and the global economy to be a moral failing on all of our parts. That's a joke, obviously. Nobody thought that, of course. Yeah. That didn't even cross your mind. The morality are the real world impact of what you're doing.
Bill shouting, get in there, my son. Get in there,
get
my
up
son.
Them stairs.
What did he say?
Get up them stairs. He used to, whenever his trade was going his way, he said, get up them stairs. He fucking loved it. And we loved it as well, because we were copying Bill. Bill was his scour trading guy. But I don't think the traders are not immoral people. Trading is this amazing, beautiful space of trained amorality.
Right.
They don't want people to be hurt. They're not actively trying to hurt people. But it's this trained amorality. Your job is to be right. Yeah. You, when you play football, you're not thinking about morality. You're trying to win. And it's...
Oh, you know, we had ethics, you know, I mean, in our... Yeah. I mean, in Gaelic games, you know, okay. our games...
But I know, I take your point.
Joe's going to make a point about the GAA, but I take your point.
In professional sport... Yeah.
But this is... I don't want to point at the traders and be like, they're the bad guys, right?
Oh, no, yeah.
This is the space that we inhabit. And, you know, I go on to make millions of pounds by betting on the collapse of the economy. And nobody ever says, you know, there's no bell to go and ring and say, guys, ding, 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 global economy is going to collapse. Maybe we should tell someone. Our job is to bet on it. And I think, zoom out from the traders, the world that we live in, the best paid 10,000 economists in the world are all traders. Yeah. And they are legally barred from speaking publicly. Listen, if I was still a trader, I'd be 10 million pounds richer and I'd not be allowed to speak to you. This is the world that we live in. We have created a world which aggressively incentivizes all the best economists, bet on it, don't talk about it. And it's not the fault of the individual traders that we've made this world. This is the world that we live in.
Yeah, because it's what the book shows very clearly is what people need to be educated on, that the system is entirely rigged against them.
It's systemic.
You are being screwed, you know, and people who are going about their honest affairs. But I wanted to come back to because you've said two or three times about, you know, look, they're not all bad people. And again, I think that, you know, for anybody of any age reading this, like, I don't know, I laughed. I had to try and stop laughing out loud.
Because
in the court. Yeah. Yeah, you can multitask. You pick it up. You pick it up, you know. It's a bit like yourself. It's playing poker, you know, with the witness. But the intoxicating side of it, the exciting side of it, and I suppose also when you were a young man, you know, the massive drinking, you know, the drug taking, you know, the casual sort of, you know, once you started to become successful, this, it was, oh, just waking up, you know, sort of vaguely remembering, you know, were we socialising with Bruce Willis last night?
Yeah. There is one very notable celebrity cameo, which I won't ruin because it's a nice punchline.
But you know, the madness of the trading floor and the fact that, you know, it's a very animalistic place. And you tell the story about
Rupert,
like, Rupert was baring and gnashing his teeth, growling loudly. Like, this is sort of like a dog on his desk at you. You know.
In front of everyone. Yeah.
He was kicking his legs out wildly at the doors. His body was jerking and loud cracks were emerging from beneath him. Smashing. The doors were smashing and bouncing off the metal brackets behind. I took all this in, of course, in a moment. I didn't know what to do. The sight was quite simply fantastical. It was amazing. I couldn't tear my eyes away. No one had ever dashed at me like a dog before.
it was. I heard him. He was pissed off about something, right? And I knew he was pissed off. I wasn't trying. This guy's kind of crazy. And I just hear him, just growl, just softly growling. And then I'm thinking, don't look at Rupert. Don't. And then the growling just louder. And then this bang. And then I turn around to him, and he was like, it was lurched over, literally gnashing his teeth, man. In front of everyone, and nobody else did anything, and it was clear
that it was directed to you.
And so there's one empty seat between us, thankfully, and he was like lurched across it and just kicking bang bang, and everyone else was just ignoring it, and I don't know, it just, and then I looked, and it was 20 seconds. I looked at him because it was just unbelievable, and then I just switched back, and then he just slowly started to calm down. That's it, calm down. Never mentioned it again. It was just the madness of the. I mean, this Rupert is a beautiful character, amazing character. Mm. There's some amazing scenes from this guy. This is the public schoolboy, and weirdly, I wouldn't even describe it because he shows some amazing moments of empathy, which other characters don't show. And he helped me at some of my lowest times, and it's sort of. This is what some men are like, you know. This is what happens when you send kids to boarding school, I suppose.
But that sense of like always being, you know, there's so many funny scenes in the book where you're that outsider, like even when you go to the Japanese restaurant.
Oh, yeah. And we get given the chicken
and you eat
a piece of raw chicken.
Raw chicken, yeah. Because you've had raw fish.
But they eat raw fish.
And you don't know that there's a. I once ordered steak tartare once and asked for it to be medium rare. Yeah. So
okay.
So I didn't know.
Well, you don't know. Nobody told you these things. Yeah, yeah. Nobody told you these things. And
eating
it was eating
the wee moist towel and the, you know.
God. But that was the world. So you were kind of always on, like those, like people like Rupert kind of knew all the.
Dragging me out. Rupert loved me. So there's this one little scene that I love from Rupert where he's telling me about how he lives his life.
Can you do his accent?
Yeah. So he's absolutely fucks over a guy on the desk. He takes me for a walk and, I think he's going to apologise for fucking over my mate. But what he actually says is, Gary, I've got a problem. And I'm just thinking, oh, what's he going to say? He says, when I meet people, I have to know immediately whether I'm better than them or whether I'm worse than them. And if they're better than me, I hate them. I hate them because they're better than me. But if they're worse than me, I despise them. It's even worse because I despise them. And it's this is what happens when you train men to see competition as their primary goal, you know. And I think actually Rupert is quite a sad character. And to be honest, almost all of the characters in the book are sad in their own way.
But were you the same? It's like when you say you knew you were better than everybody there. So yeah. You had similarities with Rupert then.
I mean, I had this... My journey was quite weird, right? Because I become like the best trader, like extremely quickly. Like I'm the best. I'm 24 when I'm the top trader in the world. So it's this kind of, I never really have. And I think what's interesting, the reason Rupert takes me around is because he's very posh and he has this thing where he has to meet people and judge them straight away. And obviously when he said that to me, I thought, well, what does he judge for me? And then what I realized, and I think this is true, is he doesn't compare himself to people like me.
Correct. That's what I was going to say. It's because of your class.
Yeah, and there's this great scene in the
book. You're naturally beneath them.
Yeah, there's this great scene in the book later on when I'm like the big trader and these really rich dickheads take me out and I'm trying to go home and they're like, come with us to Dover Street Wine Bar. Come with us to Dover Street Wine Bar. And I'm like, no, I want to go home and see my girlfriend. And they're like, no, listen, Dover Street Wine Bar is great. It's full of 8 out of 10s. And then he stops for a minute and he says, but I'm talking about a serious 1 to 10 scale. And there's this moment when you realise that these guys think like 1 to 10 on their scale is like 5 to 15 on my scale. Right, and I think in a weird way, one of the reasons why I'm loved by these guys is because my existence outside of their class system allows them for a moment to breathe and not have to compare themselves. Because in their mind, I'm incomparably lower.
And you always will be as far as they're
concerned.
Yeah,
because I'm this little runt from Ilford and I speak like a Cockney geezer, you know?
It's like this story. Just from the listener's point of view, you know, we're not exhausting the stories because the book is a delight on every page, you know, scary, but also a delight and hilarious. So, like, there's loads and loads of these stories. But your story about your internship.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever, you know, you hadn't gone through the normal route of brown nosing, family connections, all of that stuff, you know, learning all the acronyms, the impenetrable things. And you realise that all of a sudden you're being treated completely differently.
Yeah.
And then you figure out it's because they've seen your astounding results at the end of your first year in the LSE.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Chinese guy comes over to you and tell us what...
So first year is... I find it quite easy. And I just got my first proper girlfriend. And I was like... She was 1 year below, so she was still in high school. And... I spent my first year just like smuggling her out the window so my mum couldn't see her. And I kind of breezed through it and got these good grades. And then second year, these weird things happen. Suddenly everyone starts recognising me. And this Chinese guy once stops me in the corridor. He just stops me like physically.
With his hand up like that?
Yeah. And then he doesn't say nothing. He just stands in front of me and just looks at me, like looks me up and down for like 10 seconds. And you can see he's like really angry. And then he just walks off. And I had no idea because... And then I said to him, I've got a good friend, Sagamalde. He's one of
that
the
was because
guys.
Your exam results
well,
were so
Well, I didn't
high.
Know. So I said, I've got a friend, Sagamalde. Lovely boy, Kenyan, Indian. And his dad owns like the entire East African soap industry, basically. And I say to him, why has everybody been weird? And he's like, well, because of your exam grades. And Saga got like the best in the maths department. So I was like, well, your exam grades are better than mine. And he says to me, well, yeah, of course, but nobody expects that from you. And I was like, this is kind of real one of my first penny drop moments when I realised like, oh my, which is that in a weird way, this is one of the biggest opportunities that I get. And I drive this through my whole career, which is that people just think people that talk like me and people are from poor backgrounds are stupid. And in a sense, this is why I win the trading game, because people don't realise that I'm winning because they think I'm just some nutter, basically. And it runs through my whole career, basically.
But even when you mentioned that internship, you talk about how, like, the other people, like, everyone knew about the internships.
Yeah,
to view, and as you say in the book, they were preparing for these internships since they were 4.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, they had stuff to show towards their, you know, they were both boosting their CV all the way through from a young age. Yeah.
But there's a big, I think there's a really interesting cultural difference being from a poor background on the trading floor, which is that because these guys mostly come from elite spaces, their existence on the trading floor is necessary for them to fit in. Have you seen American Psycho?
Yeah.
There's this one scene, he's in the back of the taxi and his girlfriend's like, why don't you quit that job? You hate it anyway. And he says, because I want to fit in. Mm. So in a sense, actually, most of these guys in these jobs are not trying to be exceptional. They're trying to fit in because these guys, their dads earned £1 million a year and all of their friends' dads earned £1 million a year. And they need £1 million a year to fit into their social circle. So they just want to sort of get the job and sit on the job and go to Movida and, you know, and go, you know, on these fancy holidays. Whereas for me, you come from my background, this money immediately takes you out of the place that you're from.
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been, and the picture you paint of it, and you've obviously got a, you know, a hyperactivity.
Yeah.
It must have been absolutely exhausting. You know, the early starts...
Yeah,
the adrenaline throughout the day, winning, losing, looking down at your screen and saying, "Jesus, I'm down 30 million," you know.
Yeah,
and then the nights and sometimes days from lunchtime onwards.
Yeah,
boozing, taking drugs till all hours of the morning.
Yeah,
resuming that, and then And then one of the very sinister aspects of it, which you've touched on, you know, which is part and parcel of the secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's one of the most disturbing parts of the story is that when you went in here and whenever you start trading, yeah, you're in one of these big banks,
mm-hmm,
it's like joining the mafia. You're not leaving.
Yeah, well, this is the first scene of the book.
Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
So the opening scene of the book is sort of like a fast forward from towards the end. So we're later on in my career and I'm trying to get out. And Caleb, who is sort of the big idol, he's sitting me down. And at this point, I'm in Japan, sort of not explained why we're in Japan. We're in a ramen restaurant in a big corporate skyscraper. And he says, I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you a story. I used to know this guy. I used to know this really good trader, the young guy, worked for Deutsche Bank. Bit like you, made a lot of money for the bank, made a lot of money for himself. Decided he wanted to leave. You know, he thought he could get out, you know, have a family somewhere, real nice idea. The problem is he didn't really know how this world works, you know. The bank, they looked through his stuff, looked through his emails, looked through his trades. There wasn't really anything there, but there was enough to put a little case together. Dragged that guy through the court for years and years and years. Till he lost everything. Didn't have any money left. Couldn't leave, couldn't have that family. And I'm sitting there watching this guy, and obviously it's pretty clear what the guy's trying to imply. And you're feeling like your body's on fire. And you're just thinking like, fuck, I'm in trouble here. And then he says to me, literally says to me, I like you, Gary. I think you're a good person. But sometimes bad things happen to good people. We can make life very difficult for you. And this is a kind of, you know, it's kind of crazy for me because I grew up, you know, in East London in a very poor background, and I got expelled from school for drugs, and I was never a criminal by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, I knew people that were in this kind of world. And you kind of think, well, I'm going to get my head down, I'm going to study, and I'm going to do it the right way. And then you end up 10 years later basically getting threatened as if the guy's a gangster. And I think there's this beautiful message about the world there, which is that kids like me, we see those skyscrapers and we think those guys are respectable. But actually what I learned through like being a trader is these guys, traders, and these guys, the drug dealers I grew up with, exactly the same fucking, exact the same personality type, the same character type, young, dumb, full of cum, we used to call them on the trading floor. Young, aggressive, ambitious, those kinds of men. If those traders were born where I was born, they'd be drug dealers. And if those drug dealers went to Rupert's public school, they'd be traders.
It's a thing that we have talked about a lot, and I have thought about a lot, travelled a lot to learn. I mean, to learn about how Goldman Sachs works. You know, I've spent days there on the trading floors and understand how it all works, the power, the real power in the world, where it emanates from. And, I mean, depressing in the courts is that in the criminal courts, I mean, it's the people from the poverty stricken areas.
You know,
you're not, I mean, a hard pressed police force with very few public resources, whenever that depends, for example, on a conservative government allocating sufficient resources.
Yeah.
I don't have any incentive to do that because it might in turn end up with, you know, tax inspections of them and, you know, properly resourced prosecutors, you know, who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
To go after, you know, the people who, as you describe it, blew up the world's financial system.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, you steal a bottle of spring water or a bottle of cider.
Yeah.
You know, and it's your fifth or sixth offence, you're going to prison for 6 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a very good analogy that you make between, you know, drug dealing or, you know, low-level financial swindling and what's happening on that vast level, you know, the level that you worked at. I think a better analogy might be, you know, of drug dealing and pharmaceutical companies. You know, we saw Purdue Pharma, you know, the respectable face of it, you know, essentially drug dealers working within the law, but on a vast scale. I mean, you know, the manufacturers of fentanyl, of oxycodone. And And ordinary people look at that and think, how do they get away with this? Of course, it's presented in an entirely different way by the media.
Yeah.
But in a way, it brings us back to where we started, which is it better to know all the things that you know or to continue to live under the happy illusion?
Mate, this is a good question. You know, when... So last year in September, when the Liz Truss budget came out, this disastrous budget, she cut taxes on rich people a lot. And I campaign now for like higher taxes on the rich. So when this happened, I felt, number one, I knew it'd be a disaster for the economy. And number two, I felt like it, in a sense, I was personally responsible because I campaigned against this. And obviously I'm not doing my job well enough if she does it. And I knew it was going to be a disaster, massive, massive, massive disaster straight away. And
just on the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing inequality blowing up, living standards collapsing, and you come in, I'm going to slash taxes for rich people, bankrupt the state. It's a disaster waiting to happen. And this was the first time where I actually sat and thought, I've got a YouTube channel, right? And I'm thinking I should do a video about this. And the thought went through my head, don't make the video. Don't make the video. Because you've lost and it's going to be a fucking disaster for the people of this country and you can't help them. So maybe it's better you just fucking don't tell them. Because you go out every week saying there's going to be a collapse in the economy and maybe it's better they just don't know. That thought went through my head. But I made the video because if people don't know, we don't fucking stop it. And maybe people do know and we still don't stop it.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Can you say about that though? Because like that moment in the book when you talk about, you know, realizing where the balance was going, you have this line, it was inequality that would grow and grow and get worse until it dominated and killed the economy that contained it. It wasn't temporary. It was terminal. It was the end of the economy. It was cancer. And I knew what that meant. Now, if this was a kind of a sugary Hollywood film at that moment, you would begin your crusade against inequality. But that meant, in the next line in the book, it meant I had to buy green euro dollars. So you're still betting. But we've had two, like this book is set around, you know, 2008 and the crash. Since then we've had the pandemic. And inequality has got worse and worse. And so when you look at that line now, when you look at those words now, how much worse do you think it is now than when that time?
The two things are very similar in a way, but the handling of the 2008 crisis and the handling of COVID were both handled in such a way that they basically guaranteed a massive increase in inequality and that the rich actually enormously benefited in the long run from the crises.
Disaster capitalism.
It is a disaster. I mean, living standards, I think for your average person are worse now, significantly worse now than they were before 2008. I think that was true even before COVID. And I think since COVID, living standards have got significantly, significantly worse. It's a disaster. And I think that our best chance, the reason I have decided to do what I do to write like a book, which is very story driven rather than economics book, to write, to have a YouTube channel. I think our best hope in my mind is to establish the understanding in the man or woman on the street that unless we deal with this problem of rapidly growing wealth inequality, living standards will get worse. And that's a depressing message because inequality is growing quickly, but the power it has is that it's true, that it's correct. So,
and it's difficult to fight against the message, which is constant. We see it in our media in Ireland. Yeah. We're nowhere near the sort of shit show that's going on in England.
Yeah.
But we see this message all the time, you know, that clearly favours the idea of cutting taxes, incentivising, you know, reducing or abolishing inheritance tax, reducing all the wealth taxes or dispensing with them altogether, you know, and then on the other hand, the stigmatising of the people who have nothing.
Yeah.
You know, the attack on people who live in poverty in England has been absolutely shocking, you know.
Yeah.
The people in disability who are almost triumphant, and it's these huge consulting firms who are making billions.
Yeah.
Who are essentially entrenching and worsening the poverty of people who are already in poverty. Uh-huh. And the unrealistic portrayal of that. And that's why this book is so important, I think. You know, and maybe you would speak a bit about the message that you're evangelizing now since your redemption, your freedom away from...
Yeah, listen, I made my money, my big money, by understanding that inequality is, especially inequality of wealth. So I'm not talking about people earning 60 grand, 100 grand, maybe, God forgive, you know, 200, 300 grand a year. This is about families, super, super wealthy families. Their wealth is growing, and that is sucking wealth out of the ordinary economy, sucking wealth out of ordinary families, sucking wealth out of governments, and it's slowly bankrupting the middle class in governments, and that will collapse living standards. And that was, you know, this moment when I realised this in the book, that's 2011, I put my bet on, and I become Citibank's top trader in the year that year. And I
Just tell us a wee bit about that bet.
So basically, in 2008, you guys will probably remember, interest rates got cut to zero. My job is basically betting on interest rates. So because interest rates are zero, 2008, it's basically when will interest rates go up, which is when will the economy recover. And everybody thought, and this is quite reminiscent of like 2020, COVID, we're going to get a big bounce back. Do you remember pent-up demand, roaring 20s? 2009, that doesn't happen. 2010, that doesn't happen. We're sitting in the beginning of 2011 and I'm kind of trying to figure out why do things never get better? Because, you know, I've studied economics. I know the theory, low rates are going to help you spend, help your man on the street spend. And it just wasn't getting through. You know, there's this great scene where Billy, this scouse who never went to university, basically tells me, listen, fuck the books. Go home and ask your mum. Talk to your friends. Talk to your friends' mums. Go walk down the street. Look at the adverts on the tube. That's the real economy. And I start asking people and you realise everyone's fucked. You know, it's 2011, and all of my mates, I've got like an entire friendship group whose parents own houses, who they themselves will never afford houses. And you're realising it's not getting through. And then 2011, you guys will probably know, is the beginning of the sovereign debt crisis. And I get called into a meeting early 2011 with one of Citibank's best economists. And he's basically saying, all the governments are bankrupt. Spain, Ireland, of course, Italy, Portugal, Greece, but also the UK, US, Japan. They're all massively spending more than their incomes, debts are increasing, selling off their assets. And you see this image of ordinary families losing their assets, going into debt, governments losing their assets, going into debt. And what I couldn't square was, it's impossible for everybody to lose their assets and go into debt at the same time, because the assets still exist, the debt has to be to somebody. And there's this penny drop moment when I look around me and I realise, like, I'm surrounded by millionaires. And it's us. Like, this is what's happening. This is the transfer of wealth. And that's when we get this scene where I suddenly realise this is the key fundamental problem. It's inequality. Economists don't realise it. Economists don't study this university. And crucially, it doesn't get better.
But maybe there's another reason for that, a more insidious reason, which is that economists who start writing like that, Thomas Piketty, people like that, they're blacklisted. They're not going to Aspen. They're not getting $100,000 for the talk at the...
It's so funny you say that.
Unless you are towing the sort of neoliberal line, unless you're brown nosing at the Clinton Forum, you know, or Aspen or Davos, you're not making money as an economist. You're not going to have the big career.
Yes, it's funny you say that, because there was an economist at Citibank. I think it was a woman, actually. Before I started there, she wrote a piece basically saying that growing inequality is basically the core of the economy, and the economy is going to split. So she's working in markets and she's saying basically don't buy any stocks that sell to the middle class, because the middle class are going to die. You should only buy stocks that are selling to the super rich or like bare basic essentials, because that's the future. The economy is going to split into a super rich and poverty, and that's it. And she got fired by Citibank for saying, and despite the fact that this is like, it was a massive controversy. So it's funny. And I think what was really interesting is I made the same bet, but not didn't say anything publicly. And I get paid like millions of dollars. And, you know, it's, so it's.
Hence the importance of secrecy, you know. And another point, I think, it's linked to all of this.
Yeah.
Again, it's never discussed, is, you know, the how the millionaire and billionaire classes now and the billionaire elites, hand in hand with this vast wealth that's untouched by tax in many cases, is the power then to buy politics, to buy government. So we've seen that very vividly with the US, with the UK now.
But when I go on the radio, I don't do a lot of radio anymore, but I made an exception for you guys. I go on and I'm up against somebody from the IEA, Institute of Economic Affairs, and I'm going on for free. And the only reason I'm able to do the work that I do is because I'm independently wealthy and I don't need to be paid. And I'm going on against somebody from one of these think tanks, London think tanks, that sort of bought the Liz Truss government. Getting funded by billionaires. And, you know, the only reason I'm able to do the work that I do, run a YouTube, go on media, talking about inequality, is because I'm a millionaire and I can afford to fund it myself. And I have to go up against people who are funded by the billionaires. So they have the power, they have the money, and it allows them to dominate a lot of
And when you talk about changing it then, and when you talk about campaigning, like, what is the power for national governments? Because one of the things in this book, again, as we talked about, is, you know, like, you know, Sweden, all these, you know, you've never been to these places who you're having a profound effect on the lives of these people. And banks, as we know, it's a cliche at this stage, banks, you know, are far more powerful than most national governments. You know, we had the conversation here when, after the, you know, 2008, about burning the bondholders.
Yeah.
And some, you know, these things that didn't happen because...
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. Nobody ever talks about the bondholders.
Do they not?
But no, they're like the secret guys. But
again, yeah, and that was verboten.
Well, the traders, you know, the big traders in the oil, petrol, who controls our petrol, gas prices? Yeah. I mean, but nobody knows the answer to that because it's so opaque.
At a national level, like, how can you, like, clearly what has to happen is something bigger than any one government saying.
Yeah.
Because they'll be destroyed.
The first thing to say is, I think national governments can do more. I think there's a kind of a myth that goes around that you can't tax billionaires, which kind of presupposes these guys are kind of like Gandalf-style magicians that can like teleport around. But, you know, when the UK government decided it wanted to tax Roman Abramovich, turns out that it's not so easy to put Chelsea Football Club in a bag. And these guys, what they own is assets. They own your mortgages, they own your properties. National governments can do more, but I do think you're right. I think we will struggle to make progress on this without some level of international consensus. And if you look historically at the best example we have of a time when inequality reduced, it is the post-Second World War period, and it was an international movement, and it reduced internationally. So, you know, obviously, I'm not Irish. I'm here talking to you guys. As part of an annual, I'm releasing this book internationally. I think we won this battle once after the Second World War because we had an international consensus. And I think we probably will need an international consensus, because I guarantee you the billionaires have an international consensus on the other side.
But also there was so much... division within the world. Like, if you look at America now, and even what Joe Biden has done, some of the stuff he's done with Bidenomics is probably steps in the right direction.
Yeah.
Jobs created for blue collar workers.
Yeah.
But every poll in America, they don't trust him on the economy.
Yeah.
So there is this, because Trump is coming out and delivering.
Well, that's where Rupert Murdoch comes in.
Well, it is, and it's where that message comes in, that, you know, Trump comes out and says simple lines, and they get the appeal.
Yeah. There's this quote, I think it's Milton Friedman, this like right-wing economist. He said that at times of crisis, the alternative will be chosen from the ideas lying around at the time. And I think it's increasingly obvious that we are now in a time of economic crisis. This will get worse. Doesn't bring me no joy to say that, but this is going to get worse. So we will move deeper into economic crisis. And it is certain that the political consensus will move over the next 5-10 years, simply because your average man or woman on the street are not going to accept continually dramatically falling living standards. So we will move into a new political space, and that new political space will be chosen from the ideas lying around at the time. And when I look around at the popular alternative ideas lying around right now, there is one which is screaming ahead of everything else in every country, in my country, in your country, in America, which is that the problem is foreigners, the problem is immigration, they're at the heart of the problem. And that if we don't provide an alternative, it will go that way. And then they will get in and they will not improve the economy because they're not dealing with the fundamental inequality. Yeah. And then we'll move further right.
They're just
on
distracting
that.
You. Just...
Yeah. So we, what I'm trying to do is provide an alternative message, which is that the real problem is aggressively increasing inequality of wealth, loss of wealth by the middle that is going to the super rich. You need to address that. And I think unless we can make that the biggest idea lying around, it's very hard for me not to look at what's happening now and be reminded of the early 20th century and obviously the places that that went.
Gary, it's been fantastic having you here. The book is called The Trading Game and I'd really recommend it to everybody. It's an incredible read and incredible story. Thanks for joining us.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm reviewing the situation. If you want to eat, you've got to earn a bob. Is it such a humiliation for a robber to perform an honest job? So a job I'm getting possibly. I wonder who my boss will be. I wonder if he'll take to me, what bonuses he'll make to me. I'll start at 8 and finish late at normal rate and all. But wait, I think I'd better think it out. I think I'd better think it out again.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.